Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro.
I'm Alicia García Herrero.
And on the 1st of July 2021, the Chinese Communist Party celebrated 100 years. And today, we take the opportunity to look at the past, present and future of the party, its impact on the economy and on the wider aspects. This episode is part of Bruegel's focus on global China as seen from Europe, which includes as well our monthly newsletter, Zhongguan Mundus, to which we invite you to subscribe. The link is in the show notes. Little promotion aside, I'm very happy that Professor Steve Tsang joined us. Hello, Professor Tsang. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Lovely to be here.
Professor Tsang is a political scientist and historian, and he is the director of the China Institute at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. Thanks so much for joining us at The Sound of Economics. To start with, an anniversary usually makes us look back to the past. And that specific anniversary wants to be charged with a certain symbolism by the Chinese leadership. On one hand, looking back to the past, recreating a continuous narrative for a political entity which has gone through several chameleonic transformations. Secondly, a certain pride and reference to the fact that the other Communist Party, which has been in power for long, the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, didn't last for as long as the Chinese one. And this last consideration is referred to Xi Jinping, himself, and seems to symbolize the grip of power and the process of fortifying itself against collapse. So, Professor Tsang, what is your take as an historian on the narrative building, but also on the lessons we can learn from analyzing this long history of the party?
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me. I think it's a very important subject that we have to address for the celebration of the centenary of the founding of the Communist Party. Xi Jinping is looking forward rather than looking backward. I think you quite rightly say that for a lot of the anniversary occasions, people look back into their history and try to review it and celebrate its success, and sometimes commemorate on its failures. In this case, it's all about the future. It is about Xi Jinping ushering China into a new era, and the history of the Communist Party of the previous 100 years has been rewritten in order to project the right history for the build-up to the transformation of China that Xi Jinping is going to take China into. So if you are a historian and in the commemoration of the 100th year anniversary of the Communist Party, you remember some of the enormous mistakes or failures of the Communist Party, such as the Great Leap Forward, for which something like 40 million people died as a result of government policy over 3 years, or the Cultural Revolution, for which a former General Secretary of the Communist Party, Hu Yaobang, openly admitted resulted in 1 out of 10 Chinese population having been politically prosecuted. Then you will have committed the heinous crime of historical nihilism. And that is simply not tolerated. There is only now one version of history of the tremendous success of the Communist Party in saving China from the so-called century of humiliation, steering Chinese people through the unbelievably difficult challenges that bring China to where it is today. And the Communist Party will have managed to outdo every other Communist Party in world history. The CPSU of the former Soviet Union now really is a pale comparison to the Communist Party of China, which not only outlast the CPSU, but has also managed to deliver something which no socialist country in human history has been able to deliver. And therefore, China under Xi Jinping will become rich, powerful, strong, modern, green, and absolutely just the most fantastic things in the world. This is the kind of image I think we're seeing going to be projected for the centenary celebration.
Alicia, I would like to ask you to comment on what Professor Zhang just told us.
Well, first of all, I want to thank Professor Zhang for being with us, because I do understand how, I mean, I actually think it's enormously important to have a balanced view of this 100th anniversary. And Professor Zhang is helping us do this at Bruegel. And while focusing, and rightly so, on the calamities, personal calamities that have happened during these 100 years, and notwithstanding that the success of the CCP and basically outpacing everybody else in this, at least in the communist space, we can't deny, and this is what I need to do now, that the economic success has actually happened. And if it hadn't happened, probably we wouldn't be celebrating. So I think the core to understand this success in that regard, these 100 years being accomplished, is indeed the economics, the social contract that I like to use that expression that Chinese signed. I don't know whether willingly or even being aware of it or not, maybe not at the very beginning, but certainly now, of basically giving up some freedoms in exchange for a better life. And frankly speaking, probably many other countries in the world, in the developing world, might have actually signed up that contract, just that they didn't have the contract in front of them as the Chinese did. Again, maybe they weren't aware of the contract, but the point is, with the benefit of hindsight, which is what we're trying to do here now, 100 years hindsight, that contract was there, it was signed, and it turned out to be fine because China has tripled and quadrupled its income per capita. Is that enough? That's, you know, basically not for me to judge. I was never in that situation, so it would be too easy for me to say maybe not enough. But for those who were in those circumstances, maybe by now the answer is it was enough. What are the key economic successes? I mean, the obvious ones: more than 400 million people out of poverty. Maybe not so much, to be frank, income distribution on the other side of the story, because although many were lifted from poverty, still the accumulation of wealth was very concentrated, I have to say. But overall, of course, it's a positive because everybody's better off, just not as much as others. The other, I guess, absolute success, which is economic, but it has political implications, is that China is out there as a major, not only economy, but a major, I mean, an important nation, if not one of the most important nations, one of the two most important nations in the world, for what that is worth, which is a lot for a country like China, with very, very big awareness of their nation and their race. So that is another type of success, which is built on the economics. China is not there because of its soft power, to be frank. Not because of its hard power. Maybe one day it will be, but it didn't get there because of its hard or soft power. It got there because of the China Inc. that we know, because of their outward, China Inc. was inward. So, you know, people flood into China, whether it was European companies, American companies. Now it's the China outward, So China's dominance in terms of FDI globally, especially in the emerging world. So that's the next step. Because of those two phases, in and out, as I call them, China today is one of the most, if not probably the second and maybe one day the most important economy and nation for that matter in the world. And that's something that Chinese can't forget. So in that regard, that part, and I focus on that only, can't be categorized as anything but a success. And that explains the 100-year, the way in which we read the 100-year anniversary. But again, I do agree with Professor Zhang that that's not the whole story. This was a contract. And I would even say behind this contract, we could think of Faustian contract. Yeah, because a lot was given up, just that it doesn't show in the contract. And I leave it there for further discussion.
I think Alicia raised some very important points there, and we need to recognize some other realities. One is that Xi Jinping is actually very popular in China as a whole at the moment. I would go as far as to say that if there were to be open, free, and fair elections in China tomorrow, Xi Jinping will win with a landslide. He is that popular in the country. Now, he may be, in some ways, slightly less popular within the upper echelon of the Communist Party for all kinds of other reasons. But in the country as a whole, he is very, very popular. And China is also extremely fortunate because the centenary happens to be at a time of the COVID pandemic where China is doing better than practically all the other major economies, the Western countries, in how they are dealing with the pandemic. So that makes it a lot easier for the Communist Party to make its own particular pitch. And we also need to recognize that the de facto social contract that Alicia talked about has been upgraded under Xi Jinping. Previously, the social contract was quite simply a matter of people conceding the parties to have the right to monopolize power in return for better living conditions. But under Xi Jinping, he actually upgraded it to making people in China proud of China's achievements, which means that China takes a much more hardline foreign policy approach that go out of its way to assert the success of China, and that focus on nationalism make people in China feel good about themselves, and therefore they feel good about the celebration of the 100th anniversary of the Communist Party. I'll stop there.
Well, you both somehow start to mention the internal situation of the present, which is, let's say, after looking back to the past, it's what an anniversary usually gives us the opportunity to look at, which is the current status. So you started to put it quite precisely that the actual situation at the moment is very specific. Perhaps not everyone among our listeners knows exactly what is going on. You kind of hinted, Professor Zhang, about dialectics within the party itself. You kind of hinted at that in your words before. And I wonder, and also myself, I'm very curious about to understand a bit better what there is behind the surface. Of course, we all see the power structures that Xi has been setting in place in order to fortify the party structure itself. Beyond the headlines, what is actually happening? We've seen an intensified use of technology for surveillance, but less is spoken about, for example, the presence of the party in private businesses. At least, it's not that much evident in the outside world. Perhaps you can help us a bit to navigate into what is actually going on within the party at the moment and what is actually this present beyond the narrative that is crafted, beyond the headlines?
It's a very important point that you are raising, if I may say so. Xi Jinping is a very interesting character. He openly talks about Marxism and making it clear that he is a Marxist. He doesn't talk about specifically Leninism, of the Marxism-Leninism formulation. But Xi Jinping is one of the most devoted Leninists in the history of the Communist Party of China. The only one comparable would have been Liu Shaoqi, Mao Zedong's number two, the man who wrote How to Be a Good Communist. He was the first authentic true Leninist in the Communist Party. Xi Jinping is the second one. And what does that mean? It means they focus very much on the organization and the effectiveness of the Communist Party as a Leninist instrument of control. In China, under Xi Jinping, all the changes that are going to be delivered are to be superintended and led by the Communist Party of China. He even said it openly, particularly at the 19th Party Congress in 2017, the occasion when he consolidated power and became clearly the supreme leader in China, even though he called himself the core leader, but effectively it was the supreme leader. On that occasion, Xi Jinping said, it matters not north, south, west, east, or in the middle. It matters not in what areas of work you engage in. The party leads everything. There was no exception. There was no if, no buts. And from the very beginning, when Xi Jinping became leader in China in 2012, he almost immediately launched the anti-corruption operation. Now, at the time, people thought that it was an anti-corruption campaign, and a campaign has a starting date and an ending date. For Xi Jinping, he had never intended it to be a campaign. The anti-corruption operation is forever. Because the anti-corruption campaign really is the trading name of something much more important, which is a party ratification campaign, something to weed out from within the party those who were corrupt or weak or not devoted or quite simply not sufficiently loyal to the leader of the day. And therefore, you can see, since 2012, there are now over so-called 200 so-called tigers, the vice minister and above rank of cadres being brought down by anti-corruption campaign. And none of them, not one, was a protege of Xi Jinping, which is really quite extraordinary, given the way how corruption happens in China. So what we are seeing now is Xi Jinping continuously tightening up the control of the party, tightening up party discipline, and getting the party to move back into areas that have been allowed to operate without the presence of the party for a few decades. That includes the private sector. So your major companies are now required to have a party cell or a party secretary superintending the work of that enterprise. This applies not only to Chinese private enterprises, but also to multinationals operating in China. It's going to be a process. Not all of them already have a party presence at the moment, but we are going to see them eventually getting into every one of them. It also means the distinction between the state-owned enterprises and the very, very large private enterprises will become less and less as we move forward. Now, it doesn't mean the government or the party is taking over control over the large private enterprises, whether we're talking about Alibaba or Tencent or Pinduoduo or any of those. But what it means, it doesn't mean, is that a party branch will be established, a party secretary will be appointed, and as long as those private enterprises will do what the party expects and requires to be done, the party will leave them alone. But if they begin to behave in ways that are not in line with the party, and in particular, do or say things which makes the party leadership uncomfortable, then the party operations will kick in and put pressure and make them behave properly. And this is something which I think we have to bear in mind when we look at the private enterprises. And I would just end here by adding that the premise is that all these party operations are meant not to undermine the innovativeness and the capacity for entrepreneurship of those private enterprises. Whether you see that as a round peg in a square hole, and they cannot be mixed to match, is something that you will have to make the judgment. From the party's perspective, they are not a round peg and square hole problem. They are a square peg for a square hole situation that is simply should work properly. Hand it back to you.
Well, your last point about entrepreneurship, it's quite interesting, you know, because it shows also, again, some sort of balance that is tried to achieve. Control while keeping the economic success running. And one thing that came to, you know, surprise me reading about exactly this this new operation of putting party cells inside the private enterprises was the news, the information that in a lot of private enterprises, in the end of the day, it's the owners, the bosses are the first ones who sign up to become the ones who are creating this link, because they say it's better that it's me who is the boss, who is doing the link between the party, rather than someone else, in order to not to lose control over their own private businesses. It's a very, I found it quite interesting, and beyond the surface, it shows how the relations can be a little bit more complicated than they might seem from our own lenses, which are not used to that, you know, at all. I don't know, Alicia, if you might want to add something on that, but I found it quite peculiar for our own way of thinking to understand exactly what does it mean.
Well, thank you. I think this is a very important conversation, because what Professor Tsang is alluding to, at least my interpretation, is that basically in order for the party, and we could start speaking about the future, but somehow from today's point of view, given what Professor Tsang said about President Xi's own thinking about Leninism and what that means. There's first the ideology, and second, probably the need. Yeah, if I read correctly. So, where is the need coming from? The need for control, and I think this is quite important to answer your question, is maybe without that control, the party might not be able to continue to prolong its existence beyond these 100 years, maybe 150, I don't know when, but the point is, it seems that there is first the ideology, this model is superior, second, the need. And I want to dwell on the need, because if we understand why there is a need, we can also look at, we can kind of distill the problems ahead. And you are touching on one of the key problems ahead, meaning I may need to control because perhaps there are things in the economy that, or in the society, but I'm going to focus on the economy. That's all I know anyway, that might go wrong if I don't control. Think about financial risk, which is actually quite large in China today. Think about a very rapid, although we may not realize this year because growth is going to be high, but a very rapid structural deceleration of the Chinese economy. So, you know, how are you going to keep on with that social contract that I referred to before? How are you going to pay for that lack of freedom? So you need to control, supposedly, to make sure that the means of production go in the direction you want them to go. Yeah. Think about capital outflows in China, actually capital flight from China. You don't want that to happen because you want that money to be deployed in China to create that growth, that employment needed for that social contract. So how do you do that? Well, you try to keep that private sector because that's the hen of the golden eggs, the goose of the golden eggs, but you need to control it. And how do you do that? Exactly as you pointed out, you need the best, i.e. the leaders in that private sector, to be the controllers rather than to be controlled. Because if not, they simply will not produce what you need them to produce for you to keep on that model. So the one and only way to get there is to control, but with the adherence, if I may use that word, of the private sector. So you need to induce them to accept the control and actually embrace the control. And I think that explains even other conversations we have had before. I mean, you need to give them something in exchange. And that also explains why, you know, frankly speaking, and this is my economic hat, you have companies in China, especially on the real estate space, that would not be alive anywhere else. But, you know, they're there, they create employment, they may abide to certain rules, you know, you name it. So it's this control with is an incentive-based control model so that you get to the objectives that you need for that social contract. That's the way I would look at it. If I want to use harsher words, you could think of some kind of, I know it's a little bit of a shock to use this now, but Professor Tsang did go through it, a culture revolution with a softer hand, in the sense that what you want is to abide while keep on working, while keep on producing, while keep on growing, yeah? So how do you do that? Everybody needs to watch everybody. You'd better have the best watching the rest, because if it's the other way around, then it's the old culture revolution. And you don't want to have that. You want a new type, meaning a productive type, but with the ultimate same effect, which is you control because you need it.
Well, it makes very much sense to me. One of the questions that many people ask is this successful model when it comes to the economy and when it comes to control, is it something that might create a certain appeal outside China at some point? Is this something that at some point might be exported? This is like, the floating question that many people ask, are we going to all be Chinese at some point? You know, it's a common question, like a layman question that we often hear, and with fears and or with the apprehensions or with the wonder, you know, like what exactly this would mean. Is that real? A real thing? Is that something that we should watch on, or do you think this is far off?
It's a very good question. It's a very complicated question, so forgive me for the somewhat longish answer. The first part to the answer is that no, the Chinese government is not looking to export the China model. There's no evidence at all that the Chinese government thinks that its model can be exported and can be easily copied by anybody else. Well, partly because it is fundamentally a Leninist model, And from the perspective, from the way how the party under Xi Jinping is presenting it, it is a Chinese Leninist model, which make it superior to the original Leninist model, and therefore practically impossible for others to copy if they haven't got the quality of the Chinese people to be able to deliver something like that. So we are safe in the sense of not going to be having the China model being imposed on us. Now, what the Chinese government does want to do are two things. One is to make the world safe for authoritarianism, because we have to recognize that ever since Woodrow Wilson was the president of the United States a century ago, the United States government has a policy of making the world safe for democracy. And a world safe for democracies is a world where authoritarianisms are in retreat, a world where color revolutions can happen. And the Chinese government has taken the view over some 30 years now that the ultimate goal of the color revolution is China, which means that the ultimate color revolution is to overthrow the Communist Party of China and replace it by something like a Western-style democracy. That's not to be acceptable. And that's why it's important for them to make the world safe for authoritarianism. Therefore, there is not going to be further spread of color revolutions that could potentially be destabilizing for the Chinese Communist Party's monopoly of power in China. The second thing they want to change is the narrative. Instead of the narrative prevalent in particular after the end of the Cold War, with the hubris of the so-called end of history narrative, that the only talk in town is about democratization. Democracies won the Cold War. Democracies is the best system there is. And we need to measure everything by the standards of democracy, which means Western democracies. The narrative that the Chinese government wants to put forward is that let's not talk about system, let's talk about the quality of governance and the capacities to deliver this good governance that actually improve the livings of people wherever they happen to be. And China happens to have a superior model that the Communist Party of China has made it work and is doing so much better. I mean, just look at how we China have dealt with the COVID pandemic. It's so much better. And if you want to go back a bit, look at how China dealt with the global financial crisis. It was America that brought the world into an economic meltdown with the global financial crisis. And Europe was in panic and couldn't cope with it. It was China that came out riding to the rescue of the global economy, of the global financial crisis. So in this narrative, China has a pretty good record over a period of over a decade in helping the world to deal with the most challenging global problems. And therefore, this is evidence that we need to focus on something else, which is about how you deliver governance and real result rather than look at the process. Because if you focus on the process, then you can see that in your classic model democracies like the United States of America or the United Kingdom, what do they get? They elected the like of, Donald Trump and Boris Johnson. Would you like to have a leader like Donald Trump or Boris Johnson? Or would you like to have a leader who takes a whole over 90 million strong party that work to your benefits and delivers the result? So they want to change that narrative and present China much more positively. They would be quite happy for other countries to try to draw inspiration from the Chinese model, but they are not going out to impose it, but they are going out to stop Western democracies using their model or their narrative to present China in a negative light or to persuade other countries to go the Western way rather than considering an alternative that would be more positively supportive of sustaining the Chinese model in China itself. Over to you.
Thank you. I mean, this was a comprehensive reply, but very clear. I don't know, Alicia, what you might want to add to this. Perhaps a few words from the European perspective on this and the European take.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it's, of course, everybody, I mean, this is the word proselytism. I guess I learned this, you know, it's a very religious type of concept, but we all try, we have our values. We try to export our values through all kinds of policies, In the case of Europe, even trade policy nowadays.
Or privacy policy, GDPR, for example, you know.
I mean, we can't judge, say, China without looking at ourselves in terms of perhaps exporting certain values or models. But I want to go back to what Professor Tsang said about this very important concept, which is that why not export China's model? Because nobody can actually carry it out from the Chinese perspective, maybe rightly so. But that's very different from Europe. I mean, there's no idea, sorry to put it this way, of superiority of a model because of, maybe I would even say DNA. It's about a model, maybe, you know, to the extreme, you could hear some Europeans saying this was born in Greece and, you know, and this is our origin. But it's not such a nationalistic, I would argue, rationale behind keeping that core model for ourselves because we're the one and only ones able to carry it out. That's the big difference. That's the big difference. So we do think we have a different model from the US. We even call it, according to the president of the European Commission, in the last policy State of the Nation speech, I remember very neat, very clearly her call on, I think, a market economy with social values, something like that, if I recall. I mean, it's not the model that, it's not the US model or it's not the Anglo-Saxon, even I would argue Anglo-Saxon model. So that's quite important, but it's different in nature because first, there's no sense of this model is only feasible within our borders. So maybe we're even more proselytic than the Chinese because we believe that our model can be easily exported and that is and it would actually make sense to do so. But so the irony of things is that in that regard, maybe we push it even further than they do. But think about why they don't. And this brings me to, you know, my wonderful students. I once asked, and this is just the economic part of it, do you think the Chinese economic model is superior? And the answer is, of course. And then the next question is, do you think you shouldn't be moving to a market economy model? No, of course not. This is so much. So what about if we all move into a socialist model with Chinese characteristics? Oh, for God's sake, don't do that because you break, you know, you rock the boat. If you all do the same, if you all, sorry to say, subsidize your companies. I mean, there will be so much competition, everybody dumping through. I mean, I'm not arguing, sorry, this is a little bit of a joke that's all China does. I mean, China is very competitive, very dynamic. But it is exactly the same point that Professor Tsang mentioned on a more political space, that why export something that works? Why do that? I mean, if this is a relative game, you know? And it's not a win-win type thing where if we all do the same, we'll all be better. It's like, if I do that, but you have that model that actually doesn't work and you have this huge welfare state and it's so expensive, why would you do that? This immigration policy, this is, of course, amazing. I mean, for the Chinese, our immigration policy, why on earth would you do that? So this brings me to the fact that it is slightly different, if you see what I mean, because we think, wow, our model is maybe, I mean, as everybody, yeah, it's good. We like it. Well, let's have others do it. But the Chinese are more like it. I like it. Bear with it. I protect it, as Professor Zhang mentioned. So do not try to overrun it. For that, I need to push on you so that you don't push on me. It's like a defense type approach. Same with the economics. This is not only political. Same with the economics. Your market economy is not working. Mine is superior. I mean, a lot of criticism on the global financial crisis, etc. A lot of bashing, especially on the US, but also Europe, fragmented, weak. Yeah, we hear all the time. But not necessarily for you to become like me. I mean, this. So it is a bit different, to be frank. I'm not arguing value-wise we're better or worse. That's not the goal of the conversation. But I just wanted to say it is indeed a bit different.
Perhaps as a final note, but in a very succinct manner, in a very brief manner, Professor Zhang, let's look at this future. We've seen many changes. We've been seeing the current situation. What is your prediction about the future?
If Xi Jinping will be able to deliver everything he wants to deliver, by the time he is finished, China will be one united, strong country with one patriotic people. All patriotic Chinese, whatever your ethnicity and religious belief, all subscribing to one ideology, which is Xi Jinping thought, under the leadership of one party, which is the heroic and incomparably competent Communist Party of China, led by one leader, which is the wise, kind, and most far-sighted leader called Xi Jinping. And this is where I think he would quite like China to become. But let's not forget that all projections in history are usually based on a linear projection. And in this case, it's based on what Xi Jinping has been saying himself. The world happens to be a rather complex place where events, dear boy, events do happen, and events can derail the best laid plan. And we will have to wait and see how this aspiration and the reality will interact and where China will end up. What we do know is that the direction of travel before Xi Jinping, which was that under Hu Jintao, the Communist Party of China, for the first time in its history, tried something it never tried before, which was beginning to see about muddling through. Now, that option has now been taken off the table, and there will not be any muddling through. China will, in the foreseeable future, have to follow the leadership and the vision of Xi Jinping. Over to you.
I'm speechless. It was quite something, Professor Zhang. You're right. Nothing is linear, but I need to pass it over to you. If it were linear, doesn't it look a bit scary? All of that homogeneity of thinking, of ethnicity, of... We didn't even talk about the economy, but I will end by saying, is this good for the economy? I mean, as an economist, I believe in diversity. That's what brings innovation, ideas, and therefore growth. So I'm just leaving that as an open question to the audience.
And I think this open question will be something we'll come back again in our conversations here at The Sound of Economics, but also at the newsletter which we have every month, which tries to focus on global China as seen from Europe. And I very much invite you to subscribe to the newsletter. The link is in the show notes. And I would like to thank once again Professor Zhang for the insightful conversation that he accepted to participate today. This was really, really interesting, and I'm pretty sure that we've been all learning a lot from this. So I would thank you, and as usual, remind that you can read in open access all the analysis by our scholars on our website www.bruegel.org. Thanks a lot for joining The Sound of Economics. Until next time, bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you, Professor Zhang.
Thank you, and bye-bye.